Welcome to the James Madison's Community Call.
Okay, I have a bachelor's degree in science education, specializing in physics. I taught high school physics and spent most of my career in electronics, which I actually began my career in the U.S. Marine Corps as an aircraft electronics technician, and got out of the Marine Corps, went to college to get the bachelor's degree in science education, then went back into electronics in the civilian life in numerous electronics corporations, designing circuitry, troubleshooting, analysis, and spent 20 years with Bell Telephone Laboratories and a few other companies, Mobile Vision and Industrial Timer Corporation, Dynalco Corporation, Bendix Avionics Corporation in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Anyway, I retired and turned my attention to the Planet X issue and the coming events that are now building up. And I've spent all my retirement years actually engrossed in this subject. And right now I feel that we need to bring people together to get people out of the grandstands and onto the playing field. Everybody has to become a player. And, of course, God is going to be our coach. We have to keep our minds on God, even in this world where God seems invisible. We have to walk and think and feel, imagine the presence of God with each step that we take. But all of us have to not so much listen anymore to a radio, but listen and become participants also. So that's what I like to do, is ask people in the audience to give their ideas, contribute their ideas as to what we can do to make people, well, let's just take one of many dangerous, perilous issues, and that is what you mentioned, James, the threat of nuclear reactors melting down and causing widespread radioactive fallout, causing people to slowly die of leukemia, just such as what is occurring right now in Japan, and it's being covered up. You're hearing very little about the horrible disaster, the ongoing daily deaths that are occurring in Japan. So I'd like to ask people what we can do is to heighten people's awareness, and eventually, basically, you have to make them scared and let them know that they could be the same kind of victims as those victims in Japan right now. And I was just thinking, one idea that comes to mind is to make it very graphic. You know, for example, when you want to get people really concerned, you show them pictures of reality, photographs of what's really happening. So we should try to get photographs of the horrible disasters and suffering that's occurring right now in Japan, and make posters, perhaps billboards. Put it on the internet. We've got lots of social interacting media at our disposal. Facebook, Twitter, meetup groups. Meetup groups is a wonderful way for people to communicate. So that's my idea, is to make it very graphic. Get these pictures of people dying and suffering from this nuclear radiation and let them realize that we are just a step away from that same fate. So, you know, people start thinking about it, and James will allow you to voice your ideas as to how we can publicize this danger. Because it's not just an unlikely event, it's a very likely event. In fact, with each day, the likelihood grows greater and greater. Example, many nuclear reactors are built near or even on top of earthquake fault lines. For example, the infamous Indian Point nuclear reactor just north of New York City, not too far from where I live, is built upon two earthquake fault lines. This was publicized by Columbia University, New York, Science Department. They have a geological survey there. And I got this article from Columbia University. It was published around 2008, warning of the grave danger that they found that this nuclear reactor is sitting atop two earthquake fault lines. Now, we know with this Planet X coming in, and I'll try to go a little bit into the solid evidence to prove that it's indeed coming in, but I don't want to spend a whole time on it because, you know, we get to the point where we're emphasizing, we're not so much emphasizing the idea of convincing doubters, but people are beginning to believe it, and those people who have the courage to see the reality don't need to be convinced anymore that this Earth is undergoing an unprecedented trauma. So rather, I'm going to give you some evidence to prove that this thing is coming in and causing increasing geological trauma, molestation of the Earth's crust, volcanic activity, undersea volcanic activity, gases emitting from the Earth, coming up through the Earth's mantle, through the crust of the Earth. I'll give you some of that evidence, but primarily let's assume that the things are getting worse. Even just take the evidence presented by what some people call the Supreme Court of Science in the United States, and that's the National Academy of Science. They have stated that in 2012, they expect very dangerous solar flares, solar emissions, which they say could knock out the power grid. When they say could, change that to probably will. It happened in 1859. Governor Jesse Ventura did a whole presentation on it and spoke with scientists who say they have not protected the power grids and they've just let it go unprotected, and they know these solar flares are coming. Power grid goes down, as James said, those nuclear reactors will not have the power to gracefully shut down over a long period of time. So they'll go into meltdown. It's like Fukushima is going into meltdown. We have evidence. The only good thing I could say that came from Fukushima is the factuality of it, the reality of this disaster. Before Fukushima, well, we had Chernobyl, of course, which was another reality that told us that these things do happen, not could happen, but do happen. That's a lot more convincing than telling somebody that it could happen. That's the only good thing that came out of Fukushima, is that we've seen the disaster occur, and it occurred from a tsunami. Now, on the East Coast, we have the best scientists, the best geologists in the world, who are experts on the island, the Canary Islands, and specifically the volcano, that dangerous volcano in the island of La Palma in the Canary Island chain. That La Palma Island has the volcano known as the Cumbre Vieja, which Dr. Simon Day, one of the British geologists stationed there, tells us that this western flank of this volcanic mountain has been totally disconnected from the mountain proper ever since 1949. And there's about a 12-foot gap separating this dislocated western flank of this volcanic mountain from the rest of the mountain. And there's lots of rainwater trapped in there, they tell us. This rainwater will, of course, boil and become steam when a volcanic eruption occurs. This is what Simon Day tells us, and Dr. Bill McGuire. Both of these are noted geologists at the University College of London. And they say they don't know. A few years ago, they were worried about it, but they had no immediate indication that there would be a volcanic eruption which would trigger this western flank to slide into the Atlantic Ocean and cause what's known as a landslide-driven tsunami. Landslide-driven tsunamis are proven, scientifically proven, to be much higher in magnitude than the typical undersea earthquake-driven tsunamis. They had no reason really to believe that there would be a volcanic eruption, but they were very concerned and they were warning about it in this BBC television documentary that has been aired many times by the Discovery Channel. You can find it on YouTube. It's titled Mega Tsunami. It's the one made by BBC TV. You should really go and take a look at it. It's very impressive. They go through all the scientific evidence as to how this thing will indeed, not speculation, but definitely proven, to cause, when it slides into the ocean, it will cause a tsunami that will wipe out the entire east coast of the Americas, not just the United States, but all of the Americas, from Canada, Newfoundland, all the way down through the east coast of the United States to the Central America, the east coast of Central America and South America. They say the tsunami, when that western flank slides into the Atlantic Ocean, it will cause, according to their very careful and conservative scientific studies, they have found that it will cause a wave, an initial wave, at the first plunge of this western flank. Incidentally, the western flank of this mountain weighs a half trillion tons. That's 500 billion tons of rock sliding into the Atlantic. It will cause an initial wave, they tell us, greater than two Empire State Buildings in height. Of course, it'll level out, because when a tsunami wave travels through the deep ocean, it decreases in amplitude because there's a large volume of water to distribute the water that is moved, that is motivated. But as the tsunami wave reaches the east coast, it'll take about 8 hours, they say, traveling at a speed of about 450 miles an hour. That's about three-quarters the speed of sound. Then it'll reach New York City, Boston, Miami, entire east coast in about 8 hours. People will have no advance warning at all. If it happens at 3 o'clock in the morning, people will not have the opportunity to get out in time. There'll be gridlock on all the roads. There'll be cars, just a carpet of cars blanketing the highways, all immobile. People will die in their cars, be swept away by this huge tsunami wave. They say, Dr. Simon Day says, they estimate the wave. Well, of course, it depends on the terrain and the altitudes as to where each section that is stricken by the wave, the altitude at each area. But on the average, they say it'll travel inland by about 12 miles. And you've got many tens of millions of people living on the East Coast. This is the greatest threat to our nuclear reactors. The tsunami that struck Japan, Fukushima, Japan, we saw what it did. It knocked out the power and it caused a subsequent meltdown of the reactor. Well, that's going to happen to many reactors along the East Coast. Anyway, folks, I won't go on any further, but we need to impress people on the East Coast. And this idea, you know, I've actually had about 6 years to develop a plan regarding this East Coast tsunami. And I'd like to present it to you, hopefully as briefly and yet as graphically as I can. The idea is to reach, we have to reach those few people who are going to be most sensitive and most receptive to this information. And I thought about it. Who can we reach that would be most receptive to the idea of millions of people being killed in an East Coast tsunami? And of course, the first thought that comes to mind is those people most sensitive to this idea and warning would be those who live right along the Atlantic shore, people who live in New York City, people who live in Miami, Daytona Beach, etc. So we need to reach people who live close to the shore and who are emergency medical personnel. Those are the people who are trained to deal with emergencies and not flee in fear from emergencies, but trained to deal with them. We're talking about firefighters, emergency medical people. Only those who live in Atlantic City and Boston, Miami, Daytona Beach, etc., Norfolk, Virginia. So those are the people we should focus on. We can meet them possibly through the internet. Facebook, et cetera, all the different social networking media. And that's my idea, to present this idea, but it's presented in a graphic way. Show them the films, this BBC documentary. In fact, I've been emailing a very poignant clip from this BBC documentary where Dr. Simon Day is up on top of this mountain overlooking the ocean and telling us very dramatically what would happen, and they're showing us the computer graphic presentation as to what this showing this mountain actually collapsing and falling into the ocean, plunging in and causing a huge tsunami. So that's a very moving presentation. If we could just get something like that to these targeted people, that would be my
idea. We have another guest that had something to say. Go ahead and do your first name. Tell us who you are, and go ahead.
Got any questions? What day is this going to happen?
Hello, I'm sorry, I did not hear that.
What day is this going to happen?
Well, no one knows the day, but the danger right now, I can tell you the latest reports from the Canary Islands. Throughout mid-year, this middle of this year, there have been an alarming number of earthquakes, what are called earthquake swarms, lots of small earthquakes all in one clustered area, just south of this dangerous island of La Palma. And there's actually a volcanic prominence is erupting from the seabed, from the floor of the ocean near the island. About 50 miles south of that island of La Palma, it seems like a new volcano is actually forming. This is what is being reported by the scientists who are following this. And they became very alarmed. In fact, Dr. Simon Day was presenting his reports and telling people they're very extremely concerned now because of the growing danger of an eruption, a volcanic eruption. But you know, even if there's no volcanic eruption of that Cumbre Vieja volcano on the island of La Palma, just the tectonic or the trauma that's being inflicted on that area of crustal area surrounding that island, just the trauma and the vibrations could jar that dislocated western flank loose and cause it to slide into the ocean, even if the Cumbre Vieja volcano did not erupt. So it's getting dangerous. The events this middle of this year have shown that it's getting very dangerous. It could happen any day. It's like driving on bald tires. You don't know when you're going to get a blowout. All you know is the more you drive, the more worn they get, and the greater the possibility of a blowout occurs. Yes. Okay, on the West Coast, I'd hate to even get into that. But, I mean, even if we just started out with the East Coast, that would be enough. But the West Coast is in the Hawaiian island chain. There is a growing danger there, too. You can look at the scientific reports from oceanographers dealing with the Hawaiian island chain. There is at least one island, I'm not sure which it is, but it's becoming top-heavy. And the base of it, the undersea base of the island, is becoming eroded. Of course, that's a natural phenomenon from the seawater. And as it gets eroded, just visualize an ice cream cone with three scoops of ice cream on it on a hot summer day. There's not very much of a base to that ice cream cone. It narrows at the bottom, and it's pretty top-heavy. And it's very likely to topple over as it begins to melt. And this is what we have, the same kind of danger in the Hawaiian Islands. Now, I have a friend, a guy I know, he's a former military from the first Gulf War. He knows someone, a personal friend, who is a geologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. And he tells me that this geologist tells him that they're detecting, the U.S. government has all these, you know, high-tech instrumentation and systems to peer into the earth and through the ocean depths from space. They have the technology to see what's going on beneath the crust, the lithosphere crust of the Earth, whether it be the land or the sea. And they're detecting an increase in the amount of iron, pockets of iron, a huge pocket of iron that's building up in near the Hawaiian Island chain. Of course, that's going to affect the Earth's magnetic field. Because now you're having a shift of the molten iron core, it seems, because where else would that iron come from but from the core? The core is deep down, sort of like analogous to the yolk in a soft-boiled egg, where you have a liquid yolk and a sort of a partially solid or highly thick egg white. It's a little bit different because that egg white that we're talking about, that analogy of the egg white doesn't really hold. It's more like chocolate pudding. It's molten rock mixed with other metals. That's what the mantle is. The mantle is right below the very thin crust of the Earth. And that mantle goes very deep. It goes maybe about, I'm trying to remember what I had read, something like about 1,800 miles deep. And then beneath that is a smaller molten, mostly molten iron core, not completely molten, but mostly. And when that molten iron core heats up, due to the magnetic influences, the magnetic energy that's being pumped into the Earth's magnetic field by the sun puts out these blasts, it feeds energy into the Earth's magnetic field, and then in return, the Earth's magnetic field feeds it back into its source, its field source, which is the core, the swirling molten iron core of the Earth itself. So now the core is getting heated up, sort of like you would put a raw egg into a microwave oven, and that egg becomes bombarded with microwaves, electromagnetic energy waves, which actually stimulate the molecules and cause them to heat up. Well, similarly, we have a huge microwave chamber, which is our surrounding space where all this energy is being pumped into Earth. When that core heats up, it's going to transfer a lot of heat in the form of molten columns of magma through those many hundreds of miles up toward the surface, where that magma then begins to impinge upon the underside of the Earth's thin lithospheric crust. That tsunami, when that Hawaiian island goes, when that topples into the ocean, you will have a massive landslide-driven tsunami, which, again, the scientists say, they've proven landslide tsunamis. There have been some that have been detected, and they were just amazed at how large the waves were that were created by these landslide-driven tsunamis, much more than the type we saw, much more than the undersea tsunami. So even though it's 3,000 miles away, it's going to hit the West Coast. I don't know how many miles. I guess it's 2,500 miles from the West Coast. I don't know how far it is, but when the Hawaiian Island tsunami hits the West Coast, you're going to have the same the devastating effects as you would have from the East Coast tsunami that we just talked about. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a mirrored effect. And that's, you know, what comes to mind, again, I don't want to really bring in other dangers, but what just came to mind was that ocean of debris that's floating from Japan across the Pacific Ocean, and it's reaching the west coast of the United States, west coast of the Americas. You probably heard about that. Well, I mean, there's houses, there's lumber, there's cars. Everything is floating from Japan toward the west coast of the U.S. This has been in the news recently. So anyway, what are we going to do? Well, how can you prepare? If you tell people about a tsunami, then you got to tell them what they can do. And, well, as I say, what we can do is simply warn people in advance to have a network that would be set up that would detect the beginnings, or even a day or two in advance, 2-3 days in advance, what scientists would believe might be a highly likely tsunami a collapse of an island that would cause a tsunami, and then get the people away from the coast 2 or 3 days in advance. If you wait until the volcano or the landslide occurs, it's too late, because it'll take about 8 hours for that tsunami wave to travel across and strike the coast of the Americas. It's 8 hours is not enough warning time. You need a couple of days. Buoys. They have undersea. They have sea buoys that pick up, detect these events. Yes, but they're too late. It's better to be prepared for it than to be cynical or to be doubtful about it. I know everybody has a little bit of doubt, and people want to. I would like to doubt it too. I would like to believe that it won't happen, because we don't want to see millions of people killed. Oh, yeah, so we're playing dodgeball. Let's say that the tsunami threat, the East Coast tsunami threat, is one dodgeball that's being hurled at us. The West Coast tsunami threat is the second dodgeball. Getting people quickly elevated, that could save a lot of lives. And maybe there are some, people can devise something, or it would take a lot of people working together with some really good scientific minds and inventors and engineers to come up with something individually. Can you imagine like a beach ball, okay? But not, I mean, a large beach ball that would be very tough, but yet buoyant, something that you can possibly get into and have, I don't know how it would work, but it's just the general idea, or any way that people can get themselves elevated during that period when the tsunami strikes. I mean, it's a lot easier for people to get to a higher altitude than it is for them to drive hundreds of miles and wind up gridlocking one another in their cars. Maybe that's another possibility, but we need lots of people, sensitive people, to be aware of this, and people who are proactive, like emergency medical people, especially when they know that their families and they themselves are going to be the victims. That would motivate them. So, yeah, maybe some inventions like that would help out, a simple device, like even a boat. But, of course, it would have to be a boat that would not capsize. And then you've got lots of debris, too. Whenever you have a tsunami, there's lots of devastating debris that is flung at you. So you would have to have something that's able to withstand that and maintain its buoyancy without, and it can take maybe a little bit of rolling and pitching and rolling without capsizing. A special kind of a inflatable boat is an answer. People could have these quickly, you know, at arm's length, or something that they could get within a couple minutes within their houses or apartments that they could inflate. But still, how do we do it? Well, we need to get lots of people on board. And we're fighting against a government who wants to see people killed. That's what our enemy is, a government who's trying to keep this all concealed because they don't want to disrupt their economy. They would like to see lots of people killed. It would thin out the population that would rebel against them, and it would also cause people to become so fearful that they would be obedient to the rulers, the ruling elite. So we're fighting against them. We have to organize as citizens at a grassroots level, because you'll never hear it on television. Well, you do get it on the Discovery Channel. Thank goodness they're trying to warn people. The BBC. Well, anyway, I've spoken enough. You guys, I welcome your ideas. You know, I'm just thinking like structures. Maybe structures can be built too that would be sort of like, that would elevate people temporarily. We've got so many elevated structures already. They're called trees. Lots of people were saved in flash floods by hanging onto trees. But we need something to give people buoyancy, so they could ride the wave, the water, and not sink. That's a possibility. You know, in addition, we should also work on an early warning system where people could evacuate in advance. But that's really, I don't know. It would be a combination of various plans, you know, I would think. Well, inland. They would have to go inland, but that takes time. You know, people have to jump in a car and drive inland, and then that's only when the threat occurs, but they don't know if the tsunami will actually occur. They would be taking a chance. It seems like maybe it's a lot. We should also not discard that idea, but add to it the other idea that we just talked about, and that is getting people quickly elevated, or a system where they could, you know, get elevated without having to spend all that time getting on the road and driving inland. Even if it was not as large as a hot air balloon, something to give them some buoyancy. Maybe there's the technology for that. But, you know, I mean, it's such a multifaceted peril. As we started out, James, you telling us about the nuclear meltdown threat. I mean, even if you survive the tsunami, then you're going to have all these nuclear reactors melting down from the tsunami. Tsunami will knock out the power grid. And now you have people, they've survived a tsunami, but now they're going to die of radioactive fallout, leukemia. It's a significant increase in undersea volcanic eruptions and the stimulation and the heating up of volcanoes all around the world. And, of course, as you say, this is to be expected. It's quite logical that this heating volcanoes would become excited and heated up, because I like to use the analogy of if you have a big pot of chocolate pudding, and you know, after you cook it, it gets thick, and you turn off the gas, and as this chocolate pudding begins to cool down, it forms a skin, right? Very thin skin on the top of the pudding. But if you just break away that skin, the pudding below that is much more viscous, is more viscous, I guess you would say. And that under the skin is analogous to the crust of the earth. Very thin skin, very thin crust. And below it, all that chocolate pudding would be analogous to the molten magma, which is basically lava. Lava is nothing more than magma that has erupted out of the earth. And so you get the deep hundreds of miles of molten magma, which is like chocolate pudding. But down, keep on going down toward the center of the earth, and you reach the bottom of this, you know, analogous pot of pudding, which is the flame on your gas stove. So if somebody just turned on the gas stove and is beginning to reheat all that pudding, and now what are you going to have is you're going to see gas columns rising up due to the flame that has been turned on the gas range. And columns of gas are going to start shooting up to the top and causing this plopping effect. And that's what a volcanic eruption is. In addition to the magma pushing up and erupting, you have methane gases and other gases. I believe one of them is hydrazine gas. We have seen those gaseous eruptions from the Gulf of Mexico last year. We expect to see more, because that Gulf oil spill was really, they wanted you to believe that it was man-made, but it's really geological upheaval that's occurring underneath there. Underneath the seabed of the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, this geologist from the U.S. Geological Survey, I've mentioned this on a number of programs, he told my friend that, now this was 5 years ago, at least 5 years ago, long before anybody ever heard of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. 5 years ago, he told me, my friend said, they expect land masses to emerge from the Gulf of Mexico. Islands, they expect islands to form, push up out of the Gulf of Mexico. And now lately he's told me they expect the same thing to be happening around the Hawaiian Islands with all that iron. I mean, that was reported within the last couple months, really, that new volcano erupting from the seabed off the Canary Islands and forming another volcanic landmass. So it's happening all around the world. And in Indonesia, we can expect that there's what's called mantle plumes, ancient mantle plumes that occurred the last time that this huge brown dwarf star came in, intruded into our solar system on its cometary orbit. A cometary orbit is very punctual, predictable. It occurs chronologically uniform intervals. So we know when it came in 36 and a half centuries ago, and 36 and a half centuries before that, that's like 7,300 years ago, it came in again, and that would be 7,300 years ago, 5,300 BC, was when geologists tell us that the great flood of Noah's day occurred. So every time this brown dwarf star comes in, every 36 and a half centuries, you have total devastation of the Earth. Well, the last time it wasn't total, depending on how close it comes. Last time, 1650 BC, was the time of the Exodus, the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. And all the plagues that are described in the book of Exodus are actually confirmed by an Egyptian survivor of these cataclysms. And he described it in what's known as the Ipuwer papyrus, which has been for a couple hundred years displayed at the Museum of Leiden in the Netherlands. The Ipuwer papyrus really confirms the Bible and the devastation that occurred. So it occurs every 36 and a half centuries. The Earth is revolving around the sun, and it takes one year, 365 days to make one full revolution. So when this planet comes in, it comes in from below the sun, penetrates the ecliptic plane, that is that invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. It's called the ecliptic. Penetrates the underside of the ecliptic around Jupiter, between Jupiter and the asteroid belt. And then it loops over the top of goes over the orbital paths of the inner planets. First over the orbital path of the asteroid belt, then over the orbital path of Mars, then over the, as it approaches the Sun, over the orbital path of Earth, and then over the orbital path of Venus, and then Mercury, and finally it loops over the top of the Sun. It's like a huge porpoise. You know, you're on this huge placid lake, and the surface of the lake would be analogous to the ecliptic plane. And all of a sudden, this porpoise comes shooting up from under the water and comes flying upward in a big loop over the center of the lake and then back down into the lake again. That's the kind of motion, a trajectory that this object makes, because it's on an elliptical orbit and it loops around the sun. It's being pulled in by the sun, does not hit the sun because of repulsion forces that this planet, that this devastating brown dwarf star is indeed coming in. The fact that they're coming up with so much disinformation, the government, you know, like President Nixon once said, it's not the crime that incriminates them, but it's their cover-up of the crime that incriminates them. And we have seen that CIA disinformation technique used for many years. If you take a look at some of the reports, you know, about the detrimental effects of certain foods or whatever, and first they would come out with one report that says it's bad for you, and then they come up with another report that says it's good for you, and then it would go back and forth until the people got so disgusted with the vacillation and the contradictions in the reports that they had concocted, that people would just say, I'm just so sick of it. I don't care what they say is bad for me. I'm going to do it anyway because I'm tired of hearing all this. And that's exactly the technique they're using here. Mark Hazelwood really brought that out. He was one of the first Planet X researchers. Way back in 2002, he says, when this thing starts getting close, you're going to get all kinds of reports from the mass media. Of course, the mass media is owned and operated by the power elite and the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and their plan is to inundate us with so many reports of celestial objects being discovered that we get so sick of it after a while that when the real thing happens and you see that little red glowing dot in the sky and it starts getting bigger day by day, they'll just say, oh, don't worry about it. That's just another one of those many objects that we've been discovering, and people will just turn their heads and forget all about it because that's what they want to do. And they go underground, which they're planning to do right now. We've got solid evidence of their trillion-dollar underground facilities. Oh, yeah, that would be great if you could play that part one. And part six actually is the one that really shows footage and describes the underground cities. But part one is the one that describes the power grid and what is definitely going to happen according to all the scientific authorities, like NASA and the NA and National Academy of Sciences. The blasting that's going to take out the power grid next year. Yeah, go ahead. I would say play that at your convenience. Tell you what they say there. Jesse Ventura first speaks with Jim Higgins, who tells us that there is going to be solar flares that are going to take out the power grid. They explain that this has already happened in 1859 when the only technical power grid that they had was the telegraph lines in 1859. And there were some huge solar emissions, coronal mass ejections or solar flares in 1859 that actually burnt the telegraph wires and knocked out the telegraph system. Now we are very vulnerable because everything depends upon our power grid, and the government has done nothing to protect the power grid from the solar emissions. And they say, and scientist Larry Joseph is telling Jesse Ventura, that, hey, look, it's not me saying this. It's the National Academy of Science, which is the closest thing we have to a Supreme Court of Science in the United States. They are telling us that we're going to have solar emissions, solar blasting in 2012, that what they say could knock out the power grid and convert that to will. They're never going to tell you the worst of it. And when that happens, of course, lots of electronics, all the computers that govern our society, activity of our, that keeps us going as a civilization, our food distribution, our fuel distribution, everything, all that will be knocked out and will be thrown back to a primitive existence. So, well, the first thing, you know, it's easier for us to deal with that than to deal with a nuclear meltdown and a tsunami, because at least you're in a primitive way of life, but you're still alive. Whereas the other way, with the tsunami and the nuclear meltdown, you're either dead or dying slowly. But at least we could prepare for, if we live through this, prepare for loss of power for a long term. And the grid goes down, it's a foregone conclusion that it's going to stay down. There's no way they can repair all that. And just think, even if it were repairable, which would take years, all the means of repairing the power grid would be destroyed by the breakdown of the power grid itself. You wouldn't be able to get the supplies, the technology, mobilized to repair the damage, because the society would be thrown into a primitive lifestyle. So expect the power grid to stay down and prepare to live without power. People have done it in the past. Your ancestors did it. We've got wind, lots of wind. You can use that. We're going to have tremendous winds. I mean, I don't want to say that's a bonus for us, because certainly roofs will get blown off of houses by these horrendous winds, but we can use whatever we can for the time being with wind generators and also solar panels. It's going to have tremendous solar energy being striking the earth. we can generate electricity at least from these solar and wind effects. Charge up a battery. You have deep cycle marine batteries that get charged up by both the solar panels and by the wind generator, and you can generate basic electricity, not a lot, not enough to run a refrigerator. You just have to live with non-refrigeration. Again, people have done that in the past. They had root cellars, right? You probably could tell us a lot about that, James, considering your heritage. We have to prepare for that. So it's going to be tough, folks. I mean, what should we do? Should we not talk about it and say, well, let's just watch TV and don't even think about it and wait for it to happen? I don't want to get people depressed. But what other choice do we have? One is spiritual. Maybe they're, you know, for now, you know, now with these dangers confronting us very soon, next year, 2012, perhaps we should really get serious about finding that invisible God that we all talk about, that invisible God who's with us every second, who keeps our heart beating. Just imagine this. Science cannot even keep a chicken's heart beating for very long. So how does our heart continue to beat, 6.5 billion of us, every single second? Got to be a God who really loves us, a powerful God who created us and everything around us. We have not had the will to find that God. Most of us have not had the will to actually communicate with that God in our minds. He can read our minds. We talk about God. We go to church and we learn the Bible, you know, what you should do. But the Bible says, don't just be a hearer of the word. You must be a doer of the word, or else it won't do you any good unless you're a doer of the word. And what the word says is to call out to God. That's essentially. We talk about that. Talk about that, but we don't actually do it. Actually do it. I've got my son is over here. Anyway, go ahead, James. Maybe you folks have some thoughts. I've done enough talking. I'm willing to listen to somebody else. Yeah, I mean, meetup groups are a wonderful way because, you know, that's the only way you can really meet people in your locale. You know, we won't have the internet to join together in meetup groups very long with these solar flares coming, so we better act quickly. They're not really telling us. I mean, you're hearing it, but you're not hearing it mainstream. Actually, there is some mainstream reports, even Fox News, that tell us, yeah, the power grid could get blasted by the sun next year. But they don't want you to really get panicky, so you're not going to hear much about it. But I think that grid may go down next year. We better take advantage of it. And now, if the grid goes down, we've got ham radio. We've got CB radio. We've got actually walkie-talkies that are, I understand, are highly advanced. We need to be able to communicate that way if the power grid goes down with the internet, taking the internet with it.
Yeah, that's true, because you won't have your computer.
But you know, the thing is, Pete, you brought up a good point. Now that we've got the internet, we should meet as many like-minded people in our locales as we can right now. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I know people in Texas who are just like me, but what can I do if I'm in New Jersey and they're in Texas? Like my neighbors, for example. I've tried to alert them to store food and everything. It's got enough food stored that I could help to supply them for a while. We're going to have limited mobility. If a tsunami hits, or you look at these storms. We had a snowstorm in the Northeast. That's just an example I'm giving you. It occurred in October when the leaves were still on the trees, and it caused tremendous weight on the trees such that limbs came down all over the place. Everywhere you drove, there were trees, tree limbs down. That's going to really immobilize traffic. And power lines came down, of course.
Get a scooter.
So now mobility is going to be very limited, and if you've got people in a meetup group who live like maybe 5 miles away, you'll never get there. I mean, we'll have limited mobility. I think it's going to turn out to be, we're going to be right in our homes and we're going to be stuck there. and we're not going to be able to really go anyplace at all. And we'll have to deal with our neighbors close by, people within walking distance.
Well,
so you tell them and they say, yeah, yeah, I know I should do it. Or even if they believe you, they'll say, yeah, I know I should do it, but they won't do it. They're not motivated to actually store food and store water. I've tried to store enough food that I could help supply them when they come over, and I'll tell them, I'll give you some food, give you a can of food, but in return, you have to help defend the house. I was envisioning people, neighbors living in my house with me, helping to defend the house. That's tricky too, especially when these times get difficult and people need food and water. I'm willing to share some of my food and water with people as long as they help me and join together. And as I say, maybe I'd have to make that, reach out and invite them to stay at my house. I know they would be reluctant to leave their own houses, but if they've got nothing there, no heat, no food, no water, I don't know. I would need a few people to help defend the house anyway. And as you say, with their heart, reach out with your heart. You know, a lot of that is the foundation of that concept goes toward God. If we communicate with God in our minds now, like even right this minute, if we just take a few seconds as you're listening to me talk and try to imagine the reality that God, our Savior, our Creator, is with us right now, even though He's invisible. I got somehow cut off before, but I was saying He's there. He keeps our heart beating every second, even while we're asleep. So we know God is there, but yet we don't see Him, and we have no knowledge of His presence. But once we communicate with God, then His Spirit actually drives out the evil in people, that presence of that Spirit. We could see it in the Bible, in the book of Acts, with the apostles, how they were able to influence people just with the Spirit of God in them. Is anybody listening, or did I get cut off again? I don't know. Well, that's what we have to do, and it's difficult. I would like to start. How about if we just take a few seconds, and just a few seconds, maybe 5 or 10 seconds, and just imagine. It's really not, you're not imagining a fantasy, you're imagining reality. Imagine the Spirit of God with you, beckoning you right now, with you, in love, who loves you. Sad. I really feel sad for the people who live in crowded cities. I just pray for that. I actually feel like I want to call out to God to protect them. Because when people get hungry, they're going to be breaking into each other's apartments. It's happened in Argentina. We could take and I don't want to get too much into it, but we see evidence of it in Argentina with the economic collapse. There's a guy who did a YouTube, and he wrote a book about surviving this. And it was all because of the economic collapse in Argentina. People started breaking into one another's homes. And he was driving around, and he did a YouTube video, him driving through the streets of Buenos Aires. Everybody has bars on their windows. Now, we've got to start preparing to protect our windows and our doors. And I had thought about this, too. This is something you might make a mental note of. 1/16 inch. I know it sounds like we're getting into technicalities, but I'll try to make it brief, and then you could work on it yourselves. 1/16 inch thick polycarbonate plastic, clear plastic sheet. It's called plastic sheet. Do a search on the internet. And I bought some. It's 24 inches by 48, 2 feet by four feet. And that's enough to cover the windows. And basically what I was thinking of putting was this steel mesh that they use for when they do a stucco walls. They put the steel mesh up or something like that, heavy-duty chicken wire, whatever. And you can get bonding glue that will bond the plastic, the steel mesh to the plastic. The steel mesh would go on the inside, and you would get these steel strips that are used for garage door opener hangers, where you hang a garage door. It's these galvanized steel strips they could be made, you can make a frame for the plastic that would go on the outside of your window. And people would could try to break through there, but it'd be very difficult because now you'd have this steel mesh bonded by glue to the inside of this polycarbonate, which is pretty tough plastic. And it would really slow them down. They would go looking for an easier break-in just from seeing that kind of obstructive material. Keep in mind these garage doors. You can get them at Home Depot or Lowe's Home Center. You've seen garage door opener. The operator is hung from the ceiling of your garage by these long galvanized L-shaped strips with lots of holes in them so that you can cut them and put the screw in wherever you need to. And something like that, just go to Home Depot and look around, that would make bars, quick bars for your windows that you can screw in. And, of course, rigid steel grip, actually. Did you ever see like a regular ruler, 12-inch ruler?
Yeah.
Imagine that made of galvanized steel with a lot of holes in it, and it's like 2 feet long or 3 feet long. You can cut it. You get some cutting tools and then just cut it and frame your window with it and put it across your window, and that will make sort of quick bars for your window.
Right.
You know, just figure it out. When I wake up in the morning, you know, a lot of times I wake up, my mind starts to work, and I start visualizing window protection and how I'm going to do it, how I'm going to put this in and how the screws are going to go and what's going to be mounted. And my mind went through so many different possible constructions every day when I wake up in the morning, you know, and I finally come up with what I thought was the best plan. So the window was still open. You know what I mean? If you put bars across it so that you can't open the window, then you got the sash windows, no problem. You can open it. But I've got the casement windows. You have to, they actually open outward.
Yeah.
You don't want to put bars across, then you won't be able to open the windows. Anyway, I guess I don't want to get too technical, but you keep on visualizing these things in your spare time, and you'll come up with ideas as to how to protect your windows.
Well,
but in Argentina, they have to put bars under windows because people will break in and rob them. You can look on the internet. Thank goodness for the internet. There are window bars and these what they call these scissor gates. A chain link fence. You can get some of that chain link fencing and just. I got an idea. If we go to YouTube and we between now and our next conference, let's find some YouTube things that clips that show people how to protect their houses from break-ins, and also products that are sold or companies that sell these products for your windows or whatever, but you want to stop them. See, when they start breaking in, you want to make it so they're slowed down enough that you can stop them out of your bed and stop them before they get in. Whereas if it's a window, they'll break right through in a couple seconds, and you don't have time to stop them, you know. Discourage them.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even go there because they get too many other places with windows. Yeah, that's why you need your own backup system. And I've got deep cycle marine batteries. These look like car batteries. They're much more powerful. They're more powerful than car batteries because they can be discharged deeper. But that's 12 volts right there, and you could feed that through an inverter and convert it to 120 volts. But I don't want to get into all that stuff. Well, I would say get a weapon too. Here's what you do. You have non-lethal ways of disabling people. The police recommend that you get this wasp hornet spray. That'll spray like 20 feet. And that's what they recommend. That'll really stop somebody for a while. But you should have something like that. Get a few cans of that wasp hornet spray. Also get, you know, the tree sprayers? It's like a big tank, a plastic tank, and you put water or put something in it. And you pressurize it by pumping it up, and it's got a hose. Well, you know, if you can get that kind of spray and put ammonia in that tree sprayer, that should really disable somebody or slow them down. Because ammonia is, it'll knock somebody out. Also, they have slingshots, a slingshot called a wrist rocket. Put it on your wrist, and it's got a very powerful rubber band. And it fires like you would fire a handgun. These ball bearings that it fires and, you know, could really hurt somebody. Yeah, but the government doesn't care if you are attacked. You got to get it. because pretty soon there's going to be no authority to protect anybody. And there's, you know, everybody's going to be mayhem. But the chances are they're not going to come around that when the mayhem occurs, there's going to be no governmental authority at all. There will be no, it's happened in Argentina, everything went totally chaos. Get whatever you can, whatever you need to protect yourself. The super soaker, those super soaker, what do they call them? The water guns. It's like a rifle. It pumps out a long stream of water. Well, you fill that with ammonia. You should be able to order it on the internet. Just look it up and see if you can order it. Because there's going to be no governmental authority. You know, when these disasters occur, everything breaks down, and it's going to be, you know, every man for himself. In Argentina, you had people smashing into stores, looting stores, and the police could not stop them at all. They couldn't do anything. The riots in Los Angeles, yes. The Watts riots, exactly. That's a good example of mayhem, public mayhem. You know, we're going to have that with the breakdown of food, but remember, this is going to be even worse because people, they won't have very long before they start starving. And then you won't have to worry about neighbors so much because most of the people will be disabled from the lack of water and food. You can't go very long without water, okay? So that if you can protect your house for the first couple of weeks, you'll be okay afterwards, I think. Because most people, as they say, without water, without food, they're going to be debilitated. So get that window protection or whatever you can and get some weapons and have a couple close neighbors to help you defend the house. They're going to need you for food and then everything changes. Their political views begin to change and you're on a human level. Who knows what will happen? I mean, you share your food and water with them. Sure, there's a chance that they'll just raid your house. Yeah, your best bet is to just, you know, try to keep the house, protect the house with some kind of intrusion alarm. And, yeah, we've got to try to get something like that, an intrusion alarm. And now cameras are pretty cheap and small where you can monitor anybody. If you could have backup power, you know, I've got these deep set.
It's not going to last forever.
No, but you can try. I have a wind generator, well, of course, and I have to get a solar panel to try to recharge those batteries. And also, you know something? You know the exercise bike? I've got an exercise bike that my mother-in-law had, and she never used it. You can. I've got to hook up a generator, a 12-volt generator, to that bike. So when the wheel turns, it'll turn a generator. Pedal the bike, and you're generating electricity to charge your batteries. Of course, you don't want to be consuming a lot of energy by, you know, pedaling a bike because you're going to be, that uses food. So, but I don't know what else to say. Human-generated electricity is another possibility. In wilderness survival cards, something like that could actually mean a difference between life and death when people are starving. After you run out of food, you know, eventually even a person with a good supply of canned food and dry beans, et cetera, and dry grains, they're going to run out, especially when they have to supply their neighbors and their family. And you know what? Let me tell you about water. Look this up, too. I'm going to remember the wilderness survival cards and try to get them. But here's the thing about water. You dig a hole. Now, I got this idea. I got a big lawn. You got a big blanket. You know, felt blanket or whatever
right,
it is.
Right.
Fleece blanket. In the morning, there's a lot of dew on the grass. And you take a fleece blanket and you just drag it across the lawn. I mean, this is my own idea. I've never done it. Drag it across the lawn until it gets saturated with that dew on the grass. And then wring it out into a big bucket or buckets. And now you've collected all that dew that has been deposited from the air onto the blades of grass. And you can have quite a bit of water. I've never tried it to find out how much water, but there you go. There's a survival. Now, what they say to do is you dig a hole and you put a plastic bag in there so that it, you know, it's like a big recessed hole, but that's lined with a plastic bag. Because it's colder underneath the plastic bag, you know, below the hole, below the plastic bag. Right, the water from the air condenses on that colder, especially overnight, I guess, condenses. It makes the plastic bag cold from the bottom, from the underside. And
right.
any air that's on top of, inside the bag, on top of the bag, inside it, is going to condense from the vapor state to the liquid state, and you get droplets of water, and they all flow downward toward the center of the bag, sort of like a cone would collect water. Keep some batteries charged, and if you lose power, you can still look at it. But look at the DVD over and over again with your family and learn as much as you can about survival now. Well, I think we've pretty much learned a lot of stuff about personal survival. And it's just got to call out to God because it gets so overwhelming. Just to think about these disasters that would occur and so many people are going to die, hate to think about it. Trying to warn people on the East Coast, trying to warn people about the nuclear reactor meltdown. That's difficult. We're trying to influence an entire society. You know, everybody I talk to, like us, like you and I, says the same thing. It's just they're up against a brick wall. And those like-minded people have to be in our locale so that we can get together with them in an emergency and say to them, okay, look, in an emergency, if you can get over to my house, we'll all stay together and we'll survive together because, you know, we need people to help you survive, to defend the place and to make, you know, carry on life like a little community. So if you get into a meetup group and find people close enough, there are like-minded people. There's more of them emerging every day as things get worse. So that's what we have to do is go to meetup groups and use other means of finding people. Well, even on Facebook, I guess. But that's the general idea, yeah. Get together with people in your locale. Well, you know the disasters. Take Oklahoma, for example, or take California. People have experienced really devastating disasters with windstorms and tornadoes and things that are happening like snow, unprecedented weather in Abilene, Texas. And those people are waking up because they're being struck by these natural disasters. So if the natural disasters don't kill them, they'll wake up. If they kill them, they'll never wake up. So that's what we're hoping, that the natural disasters start waking up a lot of people. And then we'll have more people to join up with. When the chaos begins, there's going to be no central authority. The elite are going underground, and we're going to be... You wouldn't have to worry about the government, I don't think. Even their force, their power of fear by force, will be gone because you look at Argentina. That was just an economic collapse, and as a result, people were smashing through stores. They were rioting in the streets. You have that happening right now in Greece and Italy, and the police can't do anything. The authorities can't. Not that we're going to be criminals, and we're not going to try to violate the law, but the point is, this authority that keeps us in fear, they're going to be scurrying underground pretty soon. They're afraid of the earthquakes and the solar scorching that's coming, like James is talking about the solar blasting. That's going to scorch the earth. And I advise all of you to go to YouTube and look at the movie Knowing, Knowing. It's very important that you see the end of that movie because they're foretelling us about the solar blasting. It shows scenes where the government is on television saying, we cannot help you. All we can tell you to do is dig deep as you possibly can because the earth is being scorched by these solar coronal mass ejections. And if you're on the surface, you're going to be killed. You can say dig as deep as you can. And people were rioting in the streets and everything. And see, I've thought about this digging now outside of my yard, digging down as deep as I can. And then we have to figure out, you put in PVC or whatever to protect that underground shelter or whatever, and so that it doesn't collapse on you. And you have a dome over that, but a geodesic dome that would reflect the heat, but I don't want to get into that right now. But it's something to keep in mind. Solar scorching problem is coming because we see what's happening with the sun. Well, it'll probably last over a period of a few years. Yet next year, they say, in 2012 and 2013, object is coming in, and what is causing excitation, electrical excitation with the sun, and that's why the sun is getting so hyperactive. Yeah, I don't know if the Mayan calendar is exactly right, but I know it's getting worse every month, and the sun is getting more and more hyperactive, and that's why James, it was his big theme of this program today, our conference, was the sun's hyperactivity and all the takedown of the power grid by solar coronal mass ejections. And of course, you know, that's going to also mean people. The worst effect would be not so much the power, losing power. Yeah, that's bad. And certainly the meltdown of the nuclear reactors, that's horrific. But just imagine being scorched to death because you're on the surface. You simply live on the surface of the Earth. The tough thing is you'd have to get pretty deep. But, you know, I was thinking of this. You put a dome, and I had talked about this with Dr. Deagle, too. And that is, you not only do you dig, but you get like a geodesic dome, which is highly reflective, and you can get this. You go to Camp Moore, some of these camping supply places, they have this reflective blanket. Look it up, reflective blanket, or some kind of material like that that would reflect the sun, and you create this dome structure. Incidentally, a dome will resist wind storms too. Because of its shape. I mean, people are going to form gangs. But James, here's the thing. Here's one good encouraging note. Disasters are going to be so devastating that people are going to be disabled rather quickly. In a couple weeks, people are going to be starving and dehydrated. And the disasters are going to make everybody so immobile. You're going to see debris all over the place. Fallen trees and everything, and the military is not going to be a big threat, I don't think, because of natural disasters. The military, you're going to be on your own, and even neighbors are going to be disabled, so that the roaming gangs that you would expect during the time of an economic collapse are going to be, as they say, they won't be able to reach you. When people run out of water, they get weak very quickly. It's not very long before they run out of water. So if you can defend the home for at least a couple of weeks, you'll be all right. That's when you start thinking about digging that deep hole, getting the PVC ready. I got stuff ready now. I'm getting stuff ready, like window defense, but I haven't put it up yet, of course. But at least you've got it there that you can put it together when the time comes. So you won't be able to run out to Home Depot and get it at the last minute. So get what you need. And when we email you, James, at jamesmadisontoday@gmail.com, we're going to talk about dome homes. There's a place called Monolithic Dome Home, and these companies where you can buy and put together your own dome. I'm not talking about a home. That's ridiculous. We can't afford thousands of dollars. But a small dome structure under which you could dig a hole and then possibly survive the solar scorching that they expect to occur. So we could talk about that too, and we should really unite with you. We have to get photographs and films of the poor people in Japan dying of radioactive poisoning and show these films. We've got the internet for now. We could show it on YouTube or whatever and start groups, meetup groups, and Facebook and Twitter, whatever, where we're dramatizing this. When people see the horrific deaths that are occurring in Japan, and with Chernobyl too, we got to maybe get films of Chernobyl. In Fukushima, we have people with cameras, cell phone cameras now that are filming that stuff, I'll bet.
Really?
That's the good thing about the technology today. We can take films of everything that happens. We don't need the media.
Yeah.
To do our filming for us. Go to YouTube and you'll find all that stuff. That's what we need to get it out. But it has to be visual and graphic. And I've seen many cases where a cell tower went up in my area and the people in the immediate vicinity of that cell tower got together and went to the town council and demanded they stop it because they were immediately affected by it. So you're absolutely right.
Yep.
And the same thing with the tsunami, what we talked about. who do you reach to warn about this coming East Coast tsunami, which is really a very high likelihood? Well, we warned the people who live right on the coast, to Atlantic City, New Jersey, Daytona Beach, Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Miami.
Florida,
those
period.
Are people, they're going to die, right. Those are the people who are going to die. Well, mainly on the coast. The ones inland feel a little bit more sheltered, I guess. So, but we reach the people on the coast, especially the emergency medical and firefighters. These people are trained to deal with emergencies. They don't run in fear because they're trained to deal with it. We have to reach those people on the coast in the emergency personnel realm.
If they've got a 500-foot wave coming at them, no one is going to be able to do anything.
Right.
That's why we have to warn them and say, look, this is going to happen. That's why we need an early warning system that will tell people, hey, look, the scientists are telling us, their sensors on this volcanic island in the Canary Islands are telling them that it looks like there's a high likelihood, a red alert for a volcanic eruption. Get your people, anybody who's smart, take your day off from work the next day and just flee before that volcano actually erupts, because it's smoldering now, it's smoking. Spain and Portugal will definitely be hit by the tsunami. It'll take 3 hours to hit Europe, Western Europe. It'll take 8 hours to hit the Americas. Well, they say 8 hours at a speed of 450 miles an hour. But if you wait for it to happen, it's too late. You'll never get out of there in time.
As we
talked about before, and I don't want to waste a lot of time being redundant, but maybe we could get elevated real quick, find, low-tech ways of getting elevated real quick. So instead of spending hours fleeing from your home inland, you could just get elevated and somehow grip onto something or whatever and endure that tsunami. I don't know. That's a possibility. Some kind of flotation, really high-impact flotation device. When a tsunami occurs, everything draws back, and the coast becomes bare. The seabed along the coast becomes bare for about a half hour. It's like drawing back for a sucker punch. If you're more than 12 miles inland, you're probably okay. Again, it depends on the terrain and the altitude. But say on the average, if it's Florida, it may go 50 miles. But the scientists say 12 miles inland. Doesn't matter how small our numbers are, they're going to grow. And those few of us who care are going to be, no matter how few we are. I'm going to have to go, too. I think we've pretty much gotten some motivation here. And we'll stay in touch with you by email, James, tomorrow. James, I got to run. But we'll get together and we'll continue this. I'll email you tomorrow. Work on developing and expanding our group. Okay? Well, likewise, God bless you for bringing us together too, James. Well, good night, folks. It's been a pleasure being with you. Right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night, John.
Good night. Talk to you by email.
Yes.